vision cameras, and some of those would be zooming in to catch his face. But there was nothing he could do about that. "Two," he called. "Select our guests." Two was Jean-Paul. He approached a knot of people roughly, and first of all grabbed the arm of a 4-year-old French girl.
"No!"
her mother screamed. Jean-Paul pointed his weapon at her, and she cringed but stood her ground, holding both shoulders of the child. "Very well," Two told her, lowering his aim. "I will shoot her then." In less than a second, the muzzle of his Uzi was against the little girl's light brown hair. That made the mother scream all the louder, but she pulled her hands back from her child. "Walk over there," Jean-Paul told the child firmly, pointing to Juan. The little girl did so, looking back with an open mouth at her stunned mother, while the armed man selected more children. André was doing the same on the other side of the crowd. He went first of all to the little Dutch child. Anna, her special access name tag read. Without a word, he pushed Anna's father away from the wheelchair and shoved it off toward the castle.
"My child is ill," the father protested in English.
"Yes, I can see that," André replied in the same language, moving off to select another sick child. What fine hostages these two would make.
"You bloody swine,"
this one's mother snarled at him. For her trouble, she was clubbed by the extended stock of André's Uzi, which broke her nose and bathed her face in blood.
"Mommy!"
a little boy screamed, as André one-handed his chair up the ramp to the castle. The child turned in his chair to see his mother collapse. A park employee, a street sweeper, knelt down to assist her. But all she did was scream louder for her son.
"Tommy!"
To her screams were soon added those of 40 sets of parents, all of them wearing the red T-shirts of the Thompson Company. The small crowd withdrew into the castle, leaving the rest to stand there, stunned, for several seconds, before they moved off, slowly and jerkily, down to Strada España. "Shit, they're coming here," Mike Dennis saw, still talking on the phone to the captain commanding the local Guardia Civil barracks. "Get clear," the captain told him immediately. "If there is a way for you to leave the area, make use of it now. We need you and your people to assist us. Leave now."
"But goddammit, these people are my responsibility." "Yes, they are, and you can take that responsibility outside. Now," the captain ordered him, "leave."
Dennis replaced the phone, turning then to look at the 15-person duty staff in the command center. "People, everybody, follow me. We're heading for the backup command center. Right now," he emphasized. The castle, real as it appeared, wasn't real. It had been built with the modern conveniences of elevators and fire stairwells. The former were probably compromised, Dennis thought, but one of the latter descended straight down to the underground. He walked to that fire door and opened it, waving for his employees to head that way. This they did, most with enthusiasm for escaping this suddenly dangerous place. The last tossed him keys on the way through, and when Dennis left, he locked this door behind him, then raced down the 4 levels of square spiral stairs. Another minute and he was in the underground, which was crowded with employees and guests hustled out of harm's way by trolls, legionnaires, and other uniformed park personnel. A gaggle of park security people were there, but none of them were armed with anything more dangerous than a radio. There were guns in the counting room, but they were under lock, and only a few of the World Park employees were trained and authorized to use them. And Dennis didn't want shots to be fired here. Besides, he had other things to do. The alternate World Park command post was actually outside the park grounds, just at the end of the underground. He ran there, following his other command personnel north toward the exit that led to the employees' parking lot. That required about 5 minutes, and Dennis darted in the door to see that the alternate command post was double-manned now. His own alternate desk was vacant, and the phone already linked to the Guardia Civil.
Are you safe? The captain asked.
For now, I guess, Dennis responded. He keyed up his castle office on his monitor.
This way, Andre told them.
The door was locked, however. He backed off and fired his pistol at the doorknob, which bent from the impact, but remained locked, movies to the contrary. Then Rene tried his Uzi, which wrecked that portion of the door and allowed him to pull it open. Andre led them upstairs, then kicked in the door to the command center. Empty. He swore foully at that discovery.
I see them, Dennis said into the phone. One man. Two. Six men with guns.
Jesus, they have kids with them.
One of them walked up to a surveillance camera, pointed his pistol, and the picture vanished.
How many men with guns? The captain asked.
At least six, maybe 10, maybe more. They have taken children hostage, you get that? They've got kids with them.
I understand, Senor Dennis.
I must leave you now and coordinate a response. Please stand by.
Yeah.
Dennis worked other camera controls to see what was happening in his park.
Shit!
He swore with a rage that was now replacing shock. Then he called his chairman to make his report, wondering what the hell he would say when the Saudi prince asked what the hell was going on. A terrorist assault on an amusement park? In his office, Captain Dario Gassman called Madrid to make his first report of the incident. He had a crisis plan for his barracks, and that was being implemented now by his policemen. 10 cars and 16 men were now racing down the divided highway from various directions and various patrol areas, merely knowing that Plan W had been implemented. Their first mission was to establish a perimeter, with orders to let no one in or out, the last part of which would soon prove to be utterly impossible. In Madrid, other things were happening while Captain Gassman walked to his car for the drive to World Park. It was a 30-minute drive for him, even with lights and siren, and the drive gave him the chance to think in relative peace, despite the noise from under the hood. He had 16 men there or on the way, but if there were 10 armed criminals at World Park, that would not be enough, not even enough to establish an inner and outer perimeter. How many more men would he need? Would he have to call up the national response team formed a few years ago by the Guardia Civil? Probably yes. What sort of criminals would hit World Park at this time of day? The best time for a robbery was at closing time, even though that was what he and his men had anticipated and trained for, because that was the time all the money was ready, bundled and wrapped in canvas bags for transfer to the bank, and guarded by park personnel and sometimes his own. That was the time of highest vulnerability. But no. Whoever this was, they had chosen the middle of the day, and they'd taken hostages. Children, Gassman reminded himself. So, were they robbers or something else? What sort of criminals were they? What if they were terrorists? They had taken hostages, children. Basque terrorists? Damn, what then?
But things were already leaving Gassman's hands. The senior Thompson executive was on his cell phone, talking with his corporate headquarters. A call quickly bucked up to his own chairman, caught in a sidewalk cafe having a pleasant lunch that the call aborted instantly. This executive called the defense minister, and that got things rolling very rapidly indeed. The report from the Thompson manager on the scene had been concise and unequivocal. The defense minister called him directly and had his secretary take all the notes they needed. These were typed up and faxed to both the prime minister and the foreign minister, and the latter called his Spanish counterpart with an urgent request for confirmation. It was already a political exercise, and in the defense ministry another phone call was made.
Yes, this is John Clark, Rainbow Six, said into the phone.
Yes, sir.
Where is that exactly?
I see.
How many?
Okay.
Please send us whatever additional information you receive.
No, sir, we cannot move until the host government makes the request.
Thank you, Minister.
Clark changed buttons on his phone.
Al, get in here. We have some more business coming in.
Next, he made the same request of Bill Tawney, Bello, Chavez, and Covington.
The Thompson executive, still in World Park, assembled his people at a food stand and polled them. A former tank officer in the French Army, he worked hard and quickly to bring order from chaos. Those employees who still had their children, he set aside. Those who did not, he counted, and determined that 33 children were missing, along with one or maybe two children in wheelchairs. The parents were predictably frantic, but he got and kept them under control, then called his chairman again to amplify his initial report on the situation. After that he got some paper on which to compile a list of names and ages, keeping his own emotions under control as best he could, and thanking God that his own children were too old to have made this trip. With that done, he took his people away from the castle, found a park employee, and asked where he might find phones and fax machines. They were all escorted through a wooden swinging door into a well-disguised service building and down into the underground, then walked to the alternate park command post, where they met Mike Dennis, still holding the folder with his welcoming speech for the Thompson group and trying to make some sense of things. Gassman arrived just then, in time to see the fax machine transmitting a list of the known hostages to Paris. Not a minute later, the French defense minister called. It turned out that he knew the senior Thompson executive, Colonel Robert Gamelin, who'd headed the development team for the Leclerc battle tank second-generation fire control system a few years before.
How many?
33 from our group, perhaps a few more, but the terrorists seem to have selected our children quite deliberately, Monsieur Minister.
This is a job for the Legion, Colonel Gamelin said forcefully, meaning the Foreign Legion's Special Operations Team.
I will see, Colonel. The connection broke.
I am Captain Gassman, the guy in the strange hat said to Gamelin.
Bloody hell, I took the family there last year, Peter Covington said. You could use up a whole fucking battalion retaking the place. It's a bloody nightmare. Lots of buildings, lots of space, multi-level. I think it even has an underground service area.
Maps, diagrams? Clark asked Mrs. Forgate.
I'll see, his secretary replied, leaving the conference room.
What do we know? Chavez asked.
Not much, but the French are pretty worked up, and they're requesting that the Spanish let us in and—
This just arrived, Alice Forgate said, handing over a fax and leaving again.
List of hostages. Jesus, they're all kids. Ages 4 to 11.
33 of them.
Holy shit, Clark breathed, looking it over, then handing it to Alistair Stanley.
Both teams, if we deploy, the Scotsman said immediately.
Yeah, Clark nodded. Looks that way. Then the phone beeped.
Phone call for Mr. Tawney, a female voice announced on the speaker.
This is Tawney, the intel chief said on picking up the receiver.
Yes, Roger. Yes, we know. We got a call from...
Oh, I see.
Very well. Let me get some things done here, Roger. Thank you.
Tawney hung up.
The Spanish government have requested through the British Embassy in Madrid that we deploy at once.
Okay, people, John said, standing. Saddle up.
Christ, that was a fast call.
Chavez and Covington ran from the room to head for their respective team buildings. Then Clark's phone rang again.
Yeah?
He listened for several minutes.
Okay, that works for me. Thank you, sir.
What was that, John?
Maud just requested an MC-130 from the 1st Special Ops Wing. They're chopping it to us along with Malloy's helo. Evidently there's a military airfield about 20 clicks from where we're going, and Whitehall is trying to get us cleared into it.
And better yet, he didn't have to add, the Hercules transport could lift them right out of Hereford.
How fast can we get moving?
Less than an hour, Stanley replied after a second's consideration.
Good, 'cause that Herky bird will be here in 40 minutes or less.
The crew's heading out to it right now.
Listen up, people, Chavez was saying half a click away as he walked into the team's bay. We got a job. Boots and saddles, people. Shag it. They started moving at once for the equipment lockers before Sergeant Patterson raised the obvious objection.
Ding, Team One's the go team. What gives?
Looks like they need us both for this ride, Hank. Everybody goes today.
Fair enough.
Patterson headed off to his locker. Their gear was already packed, always set up that way as a matter of routine. The mil-spec plastic containers were wheeled to the door even before the truck arrived to load them up.
Colonel Gamelin got the word before Captain Gassman did. The French defense minister called him directly to announce that a special operations team was flying down at the request of the Spanish government and would be there in 3 hours or less. He relayed this information to his people, somewhat to the chagrin of the Spanish police official, who then called his own minister in Madrid to inform him of what was happening. And it turned out that the minister was just getting the word from his own foreign ministry. Additional police were on the way, and their orders were to take no action beyond the establishment of a perimeter. Gassman's reaction to being whipsawed was predictable disorientation, but he had his orders. Now, with 30 of his cops on the scene or on the way, he ordered a third of them to move inward, slowly and carefully, toward the castle on the surface, while two more did the same in the underground, with their weapons holstered or unsafe, and with orders not to fire under any circumstances, an instruction more easily given than followed. Things had come well to this point, Rene thought, and the park command center was better than anything he'd hoped for. He was learning to use the computer system to select TV cameras that seemed to cover the entire grounds, from the parking lots to the waiting areas for the various rides. The pictures were in black and white, and once a venue was selected, he could zoom and pan the camera to find anything he wished. There were 20 monitors set on the walls of the office, each of them linked by a computer terminal to at least 5 cameras. Nobody would get close to the castle without his knowledge. Excellent. In the secretary's room, just through the door, Andre had the children sitting on the floor in one tight little knot, except for the two in their wheelchairs, whom he'd placed against the wall. The children were uniformly wide-eyed and frightened-looking, as well they might be, and at the moment they were quiet, which suited him. He'd slung his submachine gun over his shoulder. It wasn't needed at the moment, was it? "You will stay still," he told them in French, then backed to the door into the command center. "One," he called.
"Yes, Nine," Rene answered.
"Things are under control here.
Time to make a call?"
"Yes," one agreed. He took his seat and picked up a phone, then examined the buttons, and finding a likely one, he pressed it.
"Yes?"
"Who is this?"
"I am Mike Dennis. I am managing director of the park."
"Bien. I am One, and I am now in command of your world park."
"Okay, Mr. One. What do you want?"
"You have the police here?"
"Yes, they are here now."
"Good. I will speak with their commander then."
"Captain?"
Dennis waved.
Gassman took the 3 steps to his desk.
"I am Captain Dario Gassman of the Guardia Civil."
"I am One. I am in command. You know that I have taken over 30 hostages, yes?"
"See, I am aware of this," the captain replied, keeping his voice as calm as circumstances allowed.
He'd read books and had training on talking with hostage-holding terrorists, and now wished that he'd had a lot more of it.
"Do you have a request for me?"
"I do not make requests. I will give you orders to be carried out at once, and have you relay orders to others. Do you understand?"
Rene asked in English.
"Sí, comprendo."
"All of our hostages are French. You will establish a line of communication with the French embassy in Madrid. My orders are for them. Please keep in mind that none of our hostages are citizens of your country. This affair is between us and the French. Do you understand that?"
"Señor One, The safety of those children is my responsibility. This is Spanish soil.
Be that as it may, one replied. You will open a telephone link to the French embassy at once. Let me know when it is done.
I must first of all relay your request to my superiors. I will get back to you when I have my instructions from them.
Quickly, René told him, before hanging up.
It was noisy in the back. The four Allison engines screamed as they accelerated the MC-130 down the runway. Then the aircraft rotated abruptly, jumping into the sky for its flight to Spain. Clark and Stanley were in the communications compartment forward, listening as best they could with their heavily insulated headphones to information coming to them, disjointed and fragmentary as usual. The voice promised maps and plans when they got there, but there was no additional information on the number or identity of the terrorists. They were working on that, the voice told them. Just then a fax arrived from Paris via the American First Spec Operations Wing headquarters, which had secure communications equipment currently linked to Hereford. It was just another list of the hostages, and this time Clark took the time to read the names. And part of his mind tried to conjure up faces to go with them, knowing he'd be wrong in every case, but doing it even so. 33 children sitting in an amusement park castle surrounded by men with guns. Number at least 6, maybe 10, maybe more. They were still trying to develop that information. Shit, John thought. He knew that some things couldn't be hurried, but nothing in this business ever went fast enough, even when you were doing it all yourself. Aft, the men slipped off their seat belts and started suiting up in their black Nomex, saying little to one another while the two team leaders went forward to find out what they could. Back 10 minutes later to dress themselves, Chavez and Covington tilted their heads in the typical what-the-hell expression that their troopers recognized as news that was something other than good. The team leaders told their men what little they knew, and the expressions were transferred to the shooters, along with neutral thoughts. Kids as hostages. Over 30 of them, probably, and maybe more, held by an unknown number of terrorists, nationality and motivation still unknown. As a practical matter, they knew nothing about how they'd be used, except that they were going somewhere to do something, which they'd find out about once they got there. The men settled back into their seats, rebuckled their belts, and said little. Most closed their eyes and affected trying to sleep. But mainly they didn't sleep, merely sat with eyes closed, seeking and sometimes finding an hour's peace amid the screeching noise of the turboprop engines. "I require your fax machine number," one said to the French ambassador, speaking in his native language instead of English. "Very well," was the reply, followed by the number. "We are sending you a list of political prisoners whose release we require. They will be released immediately and flown here on an Air France airliner. Then my people, our guests, and I will board the aircraft and fly with them to a destination that I will give to the pilot of our aircraft after we board it. I advise you to accede to our demands rapidly. We have little patience, and if our demands are not met, we will be forced to kill some of our hostages."
"I will forward your request to Paris," the ambassador said.
"Good, and be sure to tell them that we are not in a patient mood."
I will do that as well," the diplomat promised.
The line went dead, and he looked at his immediate staff, the deputy chief of mission, his military attaché, and the DGSE station chief. The ambassador was a businessman who had been awarded this embassy as a political favor, since the proximity of Paris and Madrid did not require a seasoned member of the diplomatic service for the post.
"Well?"
"We will look at the list," the DGSE man answered. A second later the fax machine chirped, and a few seconds after that the curled paper emerged. The intelligence officer took it, scanned it, and handed it over.
"Not good," he announced for the others in the room.
"The Jackal?" the DCM said. "They will never—"
Never is a long time, my friend, the spook told the diplomat. I hope these commandos know their business.
What do you know about them?
Nothing. Not a single thing.
How long?
Esteban asked Rene.
They will take time, one replied. Some will be real, and some will be creative on their part. Remember that their strategy is to lengthen the process as much as possible, to tire us, to wear us down, to weaken our resolve. Against that, we have the ability to force the issue by killing a hostage. That is not a step to be taken lightly. We have selected our hostages for their psychological impact, and we will need to consider their use carefully. But above all, we must control the pace of events. For now, we will let them take their time while we consolidate our position.
René walked to the corner to see how Claude was doing. There was a nasty gash on his upper arm from that fool of a Roman soldier, the only thing that had gone wrong. He was sitting on the floor, holding a bandage over it, but the wound was still bleeding. Claude would need stitches to close it properly. It was bad luck, but not that serious, except to Claude, who was still in considerable pain from the wound.
Hector Weiler was the park physician, a general surgeon trained at the University of Barcelona, who spent most of his time putting band-aids on skinned knees and elbows. Although there was a photo on his wall of the twins he'd delivered once upon a time, after a pregnant woman had been foolish enough to ride the dive bomber. There was now a very emphatic sign at the entrance warning against that. For all that, he was a skilled young doctor who'd done his share of work in his medical school's emergency room. And so this wasn't his first gunshot victim. Francisco was a lucky man. At least 6 shots had been fired at him, and though the first 3 had merely resulted in fragment peppering on his left arm, one of the second bursts had hurt his leg badly. A broken tibia would take a long time to heal for a man of his years, but at least it was broken fairly high up. A break lower down could take 6 months to heal, if ever.
I could have killed him, the centurion groused through the anesthesia. I could have taken his head off, but I missed.
Not with the first one, Weiler observed, seeing the red crust on the sword that now lay atop his scutum in the corner of the treatment room.
Tell me about him, Captain Gassman ordered.
40s. Early 40s, Delacruz said. My height plus 10 or 12 centimeters. Lightly built. Brown hair, brown beard, some speckles of gray in it. Dark eyes. Uzi machine gun.
White hat, the former sergeant reported, biting off his words.
The anesthesia he'd been given was not enough for all the pain, but he had to tell what he knew, and accepted the discomfort as the physician worked to get the leg set.
There were others. I saw 4 others, maybe more.
We think 10 or so, Gassman said.
Did he say anything?
De La Cruz shook his head.
Nothing I heard.
Who are they? The surgeon asked, not looking up from his work.
We think they are French, but we are not sure, the captain of the Guardia Civil answered.
It was hardest of all for Colonel Malloy. Crossing the English Channel, he headed south-southwest at a steady cruising speed of 150 knots. He'd stop at a French military airfield outside Bordeaux for refueling, since he lacked the external fuel tanks used for ferrying the Nighthawk long distances. Like nearly all helicopters, the Nighthawk didn't have an autopilot, forcing Malloy and Lieutenant Harrison to hand-fly the aircraft all the way. It made for stiffness, since the helicopter wasn't the most comfortable aircraft in the world to sit in. But both were used to it, and used to grumbling about it as they switched off the controls every 20 minutes or so. 3 hours to get where they were going. In the back was their crew chief, Sergeant Jack Nance, now just sitting and looking out the plastic windows as they crossed over the French coast, cruising at 2,000 feet
over a fishing port filled with boats.
"This got laid on in a hurry," Harrison remarked over the intercom.
"Yeah, well, I guess Rainbow lives on a short fuse.
You know anything about what's happening?"
"Not a clue, son."
The helmeted head shook left and right briefly.
"You know, I haven't been to Spain since I deployed on Tarawa back in 1985, I think. I remember a great restaurant in Cadiz, though. I wonder if it's still there."
And with that, the crew lapsed back into silence, the chopper nose down and pulling south under its four-bladed rotor, while Malloy checked the digital navigation display every few seconds.
"Diminishing returns," Clark observed, checking the latest facts. There was nothing new on it, just data already sent being rearranged by some helpful intelligence officer somewhere. He left Alistair Stanley to handle that and walked aft. There they were, the Rainbow team, almost all of them looking as if asleep, but probably just chimped down, as he'd done with Third Sog more than a generation before, just pretending to sleep, eyes closed and powering their minds and bodies down, because it made no sense to think about things you didn't know jack shit about. And tension sapped the strength even when your muscles were idle. So your defense against it was to make your body turn off. These men were smart and professional enough to know that the stress would come in its own good time, and there was no point in welcoming it too soon. In that moment, John Clark, long before a chief seal, U.S. Navy, was struck with the honor he held, commanding such men as these. The thought had surprising impact, just standing there and watching them do nothing. Because that's what the best people did at a time like this one. Because they understood what the mission was. Because they knew how to handle that mission every step of the way. Now they were heading out on a job about which they'd been told nothing. But it had to be something serious, because never had Teams 1 and 2 both gone out. And yet they treated it like another routine training mission. They didn't make men better than these, and his two leaders, Chavez and Covington, had trained them to a razor's edge of perfection. And somewhere ahead were terrorists holding children hostage. Well, the job wouldn't be an easy one. And it was far too soon for him to speculate on how it would play out. But John knew anyway that it was better to be here on this noisy herky-bird than it would be in that theme park still a half an hour ahead. For soon his men would open their eyes and shuffle out, bringing their boxed combat gear with them. Looking at them, John Clark saw death before his eyes, and death, here and now, was his to command. Tim Noonan was sitting in the right-side forward corner of the cargo area, playing with his computer, with David Peled at his side. Clark went over to them and asked what they were doing. "This hasn't made the newswire services yet," Noonan told him. "I wonder why."
"That'll change in a hurry," Clark predicted.
10 minutes, less," the Israeli said. "Who's meeting us?"
"Spanish Army and their National Police, I just heard. We've been authorized to land. 25 minutes," he told them, checking his watch.
"There. Agence France-Presse just started a flash," Noonan said, reading it over for possible new information.
30 or so French kids taken hostage by unknown terrorists. Nothing else except where they are.
"This isn't going to be fun, John," the former FBI agent observed.
30-plus hostages in a crowded environment.
When I was with Hostage Rescue, we sweated this sort of scenario.
10 bad guys? He asked.
"That's about what they think, but it isn't confirmed yet."
"Shitty chemistry on this one, boss."
Noonan shook his head in worry. He was dressed like the shooters, in black Nomex and body armor, with his holstered Beretta on his right hip, because he still preferred to think of himself as a shooter rather than a tech weenie. And his shooting, practiced at Hereford with the team members, was right on the line. And children were in danger, Clark reflected. And child in danger was perhaps the strongest of all human drives, further reinforced by Noonan's time in the Bureau, which regarded child crimes as the lowest of the low.
David Peled took a more distant view, sitting there in civilian clothing and staring at the computer screen like an accountant examining a business spreadsheet.
"John," Stanley called, heading aft with a new fax. "Here's what they are asking for.
Anybody we know?"
"Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez is at the top of the list."
"Carlos?" Peled looked up.
"Someone really wants that schmuck?"
"Everybody's got friends."
Dr. Bello sat down and took the fax, scanning it before handing it over to Clark.
"Okay, Doc, what do we know?"
"We're dealing with ideological ones again, just like Vienna. But they have a definite fixed objective, and these political prisoners... I know these two from Action Direct. The rest are just names to me."
"I got it," Noonan said, calling up his roster of known terrorists and inputting the names off the fax.
"Okay. 6 Action Direct, 8 Basques, 1 PFLP currently held in France.
Not a long list."
"But a definite one," Bello observed. "They know what they want, and if they have children as hostages, they really want them out. The selection of hostages is designed to put additional political pressure on the French government."
That wasn't exactly a surprising opinion, and the psychiatrist knew it.
"Question is, will the French government deal at all?"
"They have, in the past, bargained quietly, off the stage," Peled told them. "Our friends may know this."
"Kids," Clark breathed.
"The nightmare scenario," Noonan said with a nod.
"But who has the stones to whack a kid?"
"We'll have to talk with them to see," Bello responded.
He checked his watch and grunted.
"Next time, a faster airplane."
"Be cool, Doc," Clark told him, knowing that Paul Bello would have the toughest job from the moment they landed and got to the objective. He had to read their minds, evaluate the terrorists' resolve, and hardest of all, predict their actions. And he, like the rest of the Rainbow Team, didn't know anything of consequence yet. Like the rest of the team, he was like a sprinter in the starting blocks, poised to go, but having to wait for the gun to fire. But unlike the others, he was not a shooter. He could not hope for the emotional release they would have if they went into action, for which he quietly envied the soldiers.
"Children," Paul Bello thought.
He had to figure a way to reason with people he didn't know, in order to protect the lives of children. How much rope would the French and Spanish governments let him have? He knew that he'd need some rope to play with, though how much depended on the mental state of the terrorists. They'd deliberately chosen children, and French children at that, to maximize the pressure on the government in Paris. And that had been a considered act, which forced him to think that they'd be willing to kill a child, despite all the taboos associated with such an act in any normal human mind. Paul Bello had written and lectured the world over on people like this, but somewhere deep inside his own mind, he wondered if he truly understood the mentality of the terrorist, so divorced was it from his own supremely rational outlook on reality. He could simulate their thinking, perhaps, but did he truly understand it? That was not a question he wanted to pose to himself right now, with plugs stuffed in his ears to protect his hearing and his equilibrium from the punishing noise of the MC-130's engines. And so he too sat back and closed his eyes and commanded his mind into a neutral setting, seeking a respite from the stress sure to come in less than an hour. Clark saw what Bello did and understood it for what it was. But that option didn't exist for Rainbow Six. For his was the ultimate responsibility of command, and what he saw before his eyes were the faces he'd made up to go with the names on the fax sheet he held in his hand. Which ones would live, which would not. That responsibility rested on shoulders not half so strong as they appeared.
Kids.
"They have not gotten back to me yet," Captain Gassman said into the telephone, having initiated the call himself.
"I have not yet given you a deadline," one replied. "I would like to think that Paris values our goodwill.
If that is not the case, then they will soon learn to respect our resolve. Make that clear to them, Rene concluded, setting the phone down and breaking the contact.
And so much for calling them to establish a dialogue, Gassman said to himself. That was one of the things he was supposed to do, his training classes and all the books had told him. Establish some sort of dialogue and rapport with the criminals, even a degree of trust that he could then exploit to his benefit. Get some of the hostages released in return for food or other considerations. Erode their resolve, with the ultimate aim of resolving the crime without loss of innocent life. Or criminal life, for that matter. A real win for him meant bringing them all before the bar of justice, where a robed judge would pronounce them guilty and sentence them to a lengthy term as guests of the Spanish government, there to rot like the trash they were. But the first step was to get them talking back and forth with him, something that this one person didn't feel the need to do. This man felt comfortably in command of the situation. As well he might, the police captain told himself, with children sitting in front of his guns. Then another phone rang.
They have landed and are unloading now.
How long?
30 minutes.
Half an hour, Colonel Tomas Nuncio told Clark, as the car started rolling. Nuncio had come by helicopter from Madrid. Behind him, three trucks of the Spanish army were loading up the equipment off the plane and would soon start down the same road with his people aboard.
What do we know?
35 hostages. 33 of them are French children.
I've seen the list.
Who are the other two?
Nuncio looked down in distaste.
They seem to be sick children in the park as part of a special program, the one sent here. You started it in America. How do you say...
Make a wish? John asked.
Yes, that is it. A girl from Holland and a boy from England, both in wheelchairs. Both reportedly quite ill.
Not French like the others. I find that strange.
All the rest are children of workers for Thompson, the defense equipment company. The leader of that group called on his own to his corporate headquarters, and from there the news went high up in the French government, explaining the rapid response. I have orders to offer you all the assistance my people can provide.
Thank you, Colonel Nuncio.
How many people do you have on the scene now?
38, with more coming.
We have an inner perimeter established and traffic control.
Reporters, what about them?
We are stopping them at the main gate to the park. I will not give these swine a chance to speak to the public, Colonel Nuncio promised. He'd already lived up to what John expected of the Guardia Civil. The hat was something out of another century, but the cop's blue eyes were ready for the next one, cold and hard as he drove his radio car out onto the interstate-type highway. A sign said that World Park was but 15 kilometers away, and the car was moving very fast now. Julio Vega tossed the last Team 2 box aboard the 5-ton truck and pulled himself aboard. His teammates were all there in the back, with Ding Chavez taking the right front seat of the truck next to the driver, as commanders tended to do. Eyes were all open now and heads perked up, checking out the surrounding terrain, even though it had no relevance to the mission. Even commandos could act like tourists.
Colonel, what sort of surveillance systems are we up against?
What do you mean? Nuncio asked in reply.
The park, does it have TV cameras spread around?
If it does, Clark said, I want us to avoid them.
I will call ahead to see.
Well, Mike Dennis asked his chief technician.
The back way in. No cameras there until they approach the employee parking lot.
I can turn that one off from here.
Do it.
Dennis got on Captain Gassman's radio to give directions for the approaching vehicles. He checked his watch as he did so. The first shots had been fired 3.5 hours before. It only felt like a lifetime. Giving the directions, he walked to the office coffee urn, found it empty, and cursed as a result. Colonel Nuncio took the last exit before the one that went into the park, instead breaking off onto a two-lane blacktop road and slowing down. Presently they encountered a police car, whose occupant, standing alongside it, waved them through. 2 minutes more, and they were parked outside what appeared to be a tunnel with a steel door sitting partially open. Nuncio popped open his door, and Clark did the same, then walked quickly into the entrance.
"Your Spanish is very literate, Señor Clark, but I cannot place your accent."
"Indianapolis," John replied. It would probably be the last light moment of the day. "How are the bad guys talking to you?"
"What language you mean?"
"English, so far." And that was the first good break of the day. For all his expertise, Dr. Bellow's language skills were not good, and he would take point as soon as his car arrived in about 5 minutes. The park's alternate command center was a mere 20 meters inside the tunnel. The door was guarded by yet another civil guard, who opened it and saluted Colonel Nuncio.
"Colonel?"
It was another cop, John saw.
"Señor Clark, this is Captain Gassman."
Handshakes were exchanged.
"Howdy. I'm John Clark. My team is a few minutes out. Can you please update me on what's happening?"
Gassman waved him to the conference table in the middle of the room, whose walls were lined with TV cameras and other electronic gear, whose nature was not immediately apparent. A large map, diagram of the park, was laid out.
"The criminals are all here," Gassman said, tapping the castle in the middle of the park. "We believe there to be 10 of them, and 35 hostages, all children. I have spoken with them several times. My contact is a man, probably a Frenchman, calling himself One. The conversations have come to nothing, but we have a copy of their demands. 12 convicted terrorists, mainly in French custody, but some in Spanish prisons as well."
Clark nodded. He had all this already, but the diagram of the park was new. He was first of all examining sight lines, what could be seen and what could not.
"What about where they are? Blueprints, I mean."
"Here," a park engineer said, sliding the castle blueprints on the table. "Windows here, 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 and here. Stairs and elevators as marked." Clark referenced them against the map. "They have stair access to the roof, and that's 40 meters above street level. They have good line of sight everywhere down all the streets."
"If I want to keep an eye on things, what's the best place?"
"That's easy. The dive bomber ride, top of the first hill. You're damn near 150 meters high there."
"Well, that's nearly 500 feet, Clark said, with some measure of incredulity.
"Biggest coaster in the world, sir," the engineer confirmed. "People come from all over to ride this one. The ride sits in a slight depression, about 10 meters, but the rest of it's pretty damn tall. If you want to perch somebody, that's the spot."
"Good. Can you get from here to there unseen?"
"The underground, but there are TV cameras in it." He traced his hand over the map. "Here, here, here, and another one there. Better to walk on the surface, but dodging all the cameras won't be easy."
"Can you turn them off?"
"We can override the primary command center from here, yes. Hell, if necessary, I can send people out to pull the wires."
"But if we do that, it might annoy our friends in the castle," John noted.
"Okay, we need to think that one through before we do anything. For the moment," Clark told Nuncio and Gassman, "I want to keep them in the dark on who's here and what we're doing. We don't give them anything for free, okay?" Both cops nodded agreement, and John saw in their eyes a desperate sort of respect. Proud and professional as they were, they had to feel some relief at having him and his team on the scene to take charge of the situation, and also to take over the responsibility for it. They could get credit for supporting a successful rescue operation,
and they could also stand back and say that whatever went wrong wasn't their fault. The bureaucratic mind was part and parcel of every government employee in the known world.
"Hey, John." Clark turned. It was Chavez with Covington right behind him. Both team leaders strode in, wearing their black assault gear now, and looking to the others in the room like angels of death. They came to the conference table and started looking at the diagrams.
"Domingo, this is Colonel Nuncio and Captain Gassman."
"Good day," Ding said in his Los Angeles Spanish, shaking hands. Covington did the same, speaking his own language.
"Sniper perch here?" Ding asked at once, tapping the dive bomber.
"I saw the thing from the parking lot. Some ride. Can I get Homer there unobserved?"
"We're working on that right now."
Noonan came in next, his backpack full of electronics gear.
"Okay, this looks pretty good for our purposes," he observed, checking all the TV screens out.
"Our friends have a duplicate facility here."
"Oops," Noonan said.
"Okay, first I want to shut down the cell phone nodes."
"What?" Nuncio asked.
"Why?"
"In case our friends have a pal outside with a cell phone to tell them what we're doing, sir," Clark answered.
"Ah.
Can I help?"
Noonan handled the answer. "Have your people go to each node and have the technicians insert these disks into their computers. There are printed instructions with each."
"Felipe!"
Nuncio turned and snapped his fingers. A moment later, his man had the disks and orders, leaving the room with them.
"How deep underground are we?" Noonan asked next.
"No more than 5 meters."
"Rebarred concrete overhead?"
"Correct," the park engineer said.
"Okay, John. Our portable radios should work fine."
Then teams 1 and 2 entered the command center. They crowded around the conference table.
"Bad guys and hostages here," John told them.
"How many?"
Eddie Price asked.
35 hostages, all kids. 2 of them in wheelchairs. Those are the 2 who are not French."
"Who's been talking to them?"
This was Dr. Bellow.
"I have," Captain Gassman answered.
Bellow grabbed him and walked him to the corner for a quiet chat.
"First of all, Overwatch," Chavez said. "We need to get Homer to the top of that ride, unseen. How do we do that?"
"There's people moving around on the TV screens," Johnston said, turning to look. "Who are they?"
"Park people," Mike Dennis said.
"We have them moving around to make sure all our guests are out."
It was the routine shutdown procedure, albeit many hours off in time.
"Get me some coveralls, but I still have to pack my rifle. You have mechanics here?"
"Only about 1,000, the park manager replied.
"Okay, then that's what I am, toolbox and all. You have the rides running?"
"No, they're all shut down."
"The more things moving, the more they have to watch," Sergeant Johnston told his boss.
"I like it," Chavez agreed, looking up at Clark.
"So do I. Mr. Dennis, turn them all on, if you would, please."
"They have to be started up individually. We can turn them off from here by killing the power, but we can't turn them on from this position."
"Then get your people out to do it. Sergeant Johnston will go with your man to the coaster. Homer, set up there. Your mission is to gather information and get it to us. Take the rifle and get zeroed."
"How high will I be?"
"About 140 meters above the ground."
The sniper reached in his pocket for a calculator and switched it on to make sure it worked.
"Fair enough. Where do I change?"
"This way."
The engineer led him out the door and across the hall to an employee dressing room.
"A perch on the other side?" Covington asked.
"Here's a good one," Dennis answered. "The virtual reality building. Not anywhere near as high, but direct line of sight to the castle."
"I'll put Houston there," Covington said, his legs still bothering him.
"Okay, 2 sniper observers plus the TV cameras give us pretty good visual coverage of the castle," Clark said.
"I need to take a leader's recon to figure the rest out," Chavez said.
I need a diagram with the camera positions marked on it. So does Peter.
When's Malloy get here? Covington asked.
Another hour or so. He'll have to gas up when he lands. After that, endurance on the chopper is about 4 hours. Figure 30 minutes cycle time when he touches down.
How far can the cameras see, Mr. Dennis?
They cover the parking lot this way pretty good, but not the other side. They could do better with people on top of the castle.
What do we know about their equipment?
Just the guns. We have that on tape.
I want to see those, Noonan put in. Right now, if possible.
Things started moving then. Chavez and Covington got their park maps. They used the same one sold to park guests, with the camera positions hand-marked with black sticky dots stolen from a secretary. An electric cart, actually a golf cart, met them out in the corridor and whisked them outside, then back into the park on a surface road. Covington navigated from the map, avoiding camera positions as they made their way along the backlot areas of World Park. Noonan ran the 3 videotapes that showed the terrorists' own takedown operation.
10 of them, all right, all male, most of them are bearded, all wearing white hats when they executed their attack.
2 look like park employees.
We have any information on them?
Working on it, Dennis replied.
You fingerprint them? Noonan asked, getting a negative headshake as an answer.
How about photographs?
Yes, we all have photo ID passes to get in.
Dennis held up his.
Well, that's something. Let's get that off to the French police PDQ.
Mark, Dennis waved to his personnel boss.
We should have gotten uniforms, Covington said topside.
Yeah, haste makes waste, doesn't it, Peter? Chavez was peering around a corner, smelling the food from the concession stand. It made him a little hungry.
Getting in there is going to be fun, man.
Quite, Covington agreed.
The castle certainly looked real enough, over 50 meters square and about the same in height. Mainly it was empty space, the blueprints had told them. But there were both a staircase and elevator to the flat roof, and sooner or later the bad guys would put someone there, if they had half a brain amongst them. Well, that was the job for the snipers.
Homer Johnston and Sam Houston would have fairly easy direct shots, 400 meters from one side, and a mere 160 or so from the other.
How big do those windows look to you?
Big enough, Ding.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And already a plan was coming together in the two minds.
I hope Malloy is well rested.
Sergeant Homer Johnston, now wearing park coveralls over his ninja suit, popped out of the ground 50 meters from the dive bomber. The ride was even more intimidating this close. He walked toward it, escorted by a park employee who was also a ride operator for this attraction.
I can take you to the top and stop the car there.
Great.
It sure looked like a long way to climb, even though there were regular steps heading up.
They walked under the canopied entrance, past the crowd control bars, and Johnston sat in the lead seat on the right side, his gun case on the seat next to his.
Go, he told the operator.
The ride up the first hill was slow, deliberately so, designed that way to scare the bejeebers out of the riders. And that gave Johnston another insight into the mind of a terrorist, he thought with a wry smile. The gang of 10 3-seat cars stopped just at the crest. Johnston wriggled out, taking his gun case with him. This he set in an equipment bay, opening it to extract a rubber mat, and a ghillie blanket to drape over himself. Last came his rifle and binoculars. He took his time setting the mat down. The decking here was perforated steel, and lying there would soon become uncomfortable. He deployed the blanket atop his prone frame. It was essentially a light fishing net covered with green plastic leaves, whose purpose was to break up his outline. Then he set up his rifle on its bipod and took out his green plastic-coated binoculars. His personal radio microphone dangled in front of his lips.
Rifle 2-1 to command.
This is 6, Clark responded.
Rifle 2-1 in place, 6. I have a good perch here. I can see the whole roof of the castle and the doors to the elevator and stairwell.